Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the 49th IIPC lecture, and I don't think we've ever had such a good turnout for an IIPC lecture, so thanks everyone for coming. It's obviously having such a distinguished scholar as Midwell here, and it might have something to do with Tarantino as well, I suspect. But just a quick word about the format of IIPC lectures and what we've got ahead in the next few weeks. There's another really high-profile, high-level debate coming up with J.Jack Halberstam, the gender studies scholar, and he'll be here on the 12th or the 13th? 13th of December. So look out for that. I think that one's in Yannis Hall, or is it the... In Yannis Hall. Okay, are there any more IIPC lectures coming up? I think that those are the only ones we know about at the moment. Okay, and the format of the IIPC lectures is that we have a lecture of approximately 1 hour, and then after that we can debate it, we can discuss it with Miguel for half an hour. And otherwise, I don't think there's any more IIPC news to announce. So I'll just move on and announce Miguel. Miguel's been here the whole week as a guest of the Department of Musicology. He's a senior lecturer at City University in London, which we have strong ties with. I used to occupy the same post as Miguel, and I'll be going back there for a Erasmus exchange lecture deal in February. But we've had Miguel with us all week, and he was lecturing earlier today on music technology and the voice, and earlier on in the week in a film music course lecturing about silent films. And Miguel is an expert on film music and sound, on the academic study of film music and sound, and also he's a film music composer in his own right, quite a prolific one. He does a lot of work in film. Okay, well, that's a matter of interpretation. But as far as his scholarship in film music is concerned, he's edited this collection on European film music, which is a very important piece of work, so I recommend it to everyone. And in addition, he's written a monograph on the Michael Danner film, The Ice Storm. He's also written a number of articles on contemporary film music, and one of them is an article with this name, I believe, and it's in a collected edition that I've edited myself, which is coming out this Friday, The Oxford Handbook of Sound and Image in Digital Media. So Friday is tomorrow. Sounds in fact. We were going to have another book launch, but we had one for another book a few weeks ago, and it felt like we'd be making too much fuss if we did that as well here. But there'll be a book launches later on, which you can go to either the UK or the US to attend. So he's written this article recently, and he's also written on the Danny Boyle film Trainspotting. It's a very interesting article. I don't know if it's necessary to say much more about your work. I think I'll just hand over to you, and thank you. Thank you. Tell us about this film. Thanks very much.
Before we get going, how many of you have seen the film? Okay, good. A few haven't. Okay, and how many of you have seen his film after that, Django Unchained? Okay, good. That just helps me contextualise this a little bit. Okay, one of the most heavily critiqued aspects of Quentin Tarantino's film Inglourious Basterds was its rewriting of the end of the Second World War. The film tells a story of two simultaneous plots to assassinate the Nazi political leadership. One planned by a maverick team of Jewish allied soldiers, known as the Bastards, and the other by a Franco-Jewish cinema proprietor. Both plots converge in a movie theatre where Hitler and most of his high command officers are burned alive shot and then also blown up for good measure. Daniel Mendelssohn observed that to indulge fantasies at the expense of historical truth would be the most inglorious bastardization of all. He also argued that Tarantino's celebration of vengeful violence exposed the fragility of memory, warped the representation of the past, and ultimately had the effect of turning Jews into Nazis. But for Tarantino, the boundary between mediated cinematic history and historical veracity seemed minimal. He said, and I quote, "I like the idea that it's the power of cinema that fights the Nazis, but not even as a metaphor, as a literal reality." So this extraordinary statement echoes Baudrillard's theorization in Simulacra and Simulation, that history is a lost reference that has become society's myth. If you haven't read this essay, you should at some point have a look at it, because it's very, very relevant in many ways, I think. Baudrillard claimed that society replaced reality with the signs and symbols of its simulation, so that history and reality are constantly eroded. Cinema is therefore, quote, at the service of reanimating what itself contributed to liquidating. So Baudrillard's assertion was that hyperreality occurs when reality and fiction are blended and fiction emerges as the victor. The simulation does not simply trick an audience into believing in a false entity, but signifies the destruction of an original reality that it has replaced. And now, several critics who found Tarantino's approach distasteful saw the theoretical concern posed by Baudrillard clearly articulated in the film's flagrant distortion of some of the defining aspects of the war. On his blog, Jonathan Rosenbaum called the film deeply offensive, profoundly stupid, and akin to Holocaust denial. For Rosenbaum, the diffusion of historical truth in Inglourious Basterds, with its reality derived only from other movies, made the Holocaust harder, not easier, to grasp. He explains a bit more there about what he thinks about this film. Tarantino seems to have started with the intention of honouring history, but during the writing process changed his approach because he said, "My characters don't know they're a part of history." And he further explained, "For people of my generation and younger, I didn't want to trap the film in that period bubble. I was very influenced by Hollywood propaganda movies made during World War II. Most were made by directors living in Hollywood because the Nazis had taken over their countries. I wasn't taking anything from them stylistically, but what struck me about those movies was that they were made during the war, when the Nazis were still a threat, and these filmmakers probably had had personal experiences with the Nazis or were worried to death about their families in Europe. Yet these movies are entertaining, they're funny, there's humour in them. They're allowed to be thrilling adventures." Today I want to argue that, unlike Tarantino's previous projects, the soundtrack, which is principally constructed by using pre-existing film scores or music with very clear filmic associations, represents a kind of a shift in his aesthetic approach that's allied with artistic trends in post-millennial digitally mediated society. The juxtaposition of sources in Inglourious Basterds generates multiple layers of appropriative meaning that are synonymous with the popular music practice known as mashup. In its most basic form, a mashup is where two or more samples from different songs are blended together to create a new track. And typically this involves capturing the vocal elements from one track and merging them with the instrumental sections of another. Let's listen to an example. We're going to listen to DJ Lobsterdust's Nergaga, which is a mashup of Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit and Lady Gaga's Poker Face. And we're listening to three things here. We're listening to both of those original tracks with an awareness of both those original tracks, and the third thing, how they're combined together. And I think that's key. We're not listening to one thing, we're listening to three simultaneous things here. We'll be right back. there. We could listen to more, I'm sure. A fantastic mashup. There are, for some reason, lots and lots of mashups of Nirvana and Lady Gaga. If you do an internet search, you will find hundreds and hundreds of people doing this. There's something very appealing about putting those two things together. And those of you that seem to be enjoying that most, I would suggest, are listening to the three things simultaneously. You know both of those original tracks, and you're technically impressed with how it's put together, but there's also a third thing going on about how that's mashed, how that's put together. So, to relate this idea of mashup to Inglourious Basterds, it's not simply that multiple audiovisual references exist in ironic parallelism or contrapuntal pastiche, but rather, rather that a variety of ideas rub up against one another, coalesce, and form new meanings. So strong are the genre allusions and cinematic contexts that their simultaneous presence is a constant reminder of the film's transformative aims. Earlier practices, of course, employed creative juxtapositions, but had a tendency to emphasise counterpoint or defamiliarisation, rather than the true goal of mashup culture, which is pluralism. Stefan Sonvila-Weiss argued that mashup is, quote, a metaphor for parallel and coexisting ways of thinking and acting, rather than exclusionary, causal, and reductionist principles of either or. So, in Inglourious Basterds, Tarantino creates a movie that blends audiovisual tropes from war films, spaghetti westerns, men on a mission, and action movies, blaxploitation films, horror films, and even nationalist socialist propaganda. Impish playfulness serves to present this material from a startlingly fresh perspective. So, the film enjoys the simultaneous juxtaposition of old and new, and celebrates a plurality of contexts and signification in a liminal space. And I want to focus on the soundtrack's reference to music from the spaghetti western subgenre in particular, which seems, to me at least, designed to problematise some of the very issues that Baudrillard highlighted in relation to the real and the hyperreal. And it allows historical liberties to become a reflection on the metamorphosis of fact into myth. It is the creation of this deliberate liminal space, I suggest, that challenges the audience in the film's concluding sequences. While the audience may have enjoyed the playful genre allusions and the self-aware process of mythologizing, a jolt from history ultimately forces the audience to confront their own cathartic, spectatorial position. So, let's have a look at the music used in Inglourious Basterds. What exactly is mashed? You might want to have a look at the handout, which is... This shows a chronological list of the music as it appears in the film. The left-hand column indicates the movie in which the specific music track originally appeared. And Inglourious Basterds is a World War II drama, but the music does not really conform to standard expectations of style or genre. On the one hand, music from 1940s films is used diegetically, such as the Große Liebe, but there's also a lot of non-diegetic spaghetti western music, such as Il Mercenario, war movies, such as The Battle of Algiers, blaxploitation movies, such as Slaughter, action movies, such as White Lightning, Italian crime dramas or poliziotteschi, such as Revolver, and even some 1980s erotic horror, Cat People. So a seemingly heterogeneous assortment of musical choices. But I think much of this pre-existing music can be categorised within clear film music genres. Music from war films seems to abound, although only one of these, Kelly's Heroes, is actually set during World War II. And is about a group of soldiers who go absent without leave to rob a bank behind enemy lines. Though the backdrop is Nazi-occupied France, this film is not so much about war as it is about a group of men on a specific mission. Historical referentialism, then, is not the governing factor in the selection of material for Inglourious Basterds. In fact, the recurrent pattern is that much of the music is taken from films that deal with individuals or small groups of men, normally outcasts or underdogs, who are motivated to complete a particular task in opposition to another group. So Dark of the Sun from 1968, for example, tells the story of a gang of mercenaries sent on a dangerous mission during the Congo crisis. Eastern Condors from 1987 features an ensemble of convict soldiers, clearly reminiscent of the squad in The Dirty Dozen, who are given a secret mission to enter Vietnam and destroy a bunker containing missiles before they're accessed by the Viet Cong. Slaughter, although it's a blaxploitation film, the main character is a former Green Beret captain who seeks revenge for the murder of his parents. So we have recurring themes of revenge and undercover missions beginning to emerge, and also true in the film White Lightning, where the central character seeks retribution for the murder of his younger brother. So even a very cursory exploration of some of the music that's used suggests that the musical choices are not entirely innocent, and that there are numerous resonant associations that can be made between an original track and its revised context. Thematic links primarily relating to the notion of retribution unifies much of this disparate material. Perhaps the most potent musical strand in Inglourious Basterds relates to the Western, especially the spaghetti Western. And as you can see, there's a particular focus here on the work of Ennio Morricone. Tarantino has consistently stated that he's reluctant to work directly with composers, as this would require him to relinquish too much control over his storytelling. This goes back over many, many years. There are lots of examples of him saying exactly that. Here's an interesting one. I have one of the best soundtrack collections in America. I just don't trust any composer to do it. Who the fuck is this guy coming in here and throwing his shit over my movie? What if I don't like it? That was in 2008 at the Cannes Film Festival in... When's the Cannes Film Festival? June? Something like that. A couple of months later, he had asked Ennio Morricone to score Inglourious Basterds. So there's some inconsistencies here. Morricone initially accepted the offer, but allegedly time pressures and conflicting working projects prevented the collaboration from taking place. I suspect there's more to it, but that is what they are both reporting. In the end, Morricone's pre-existing music frames the movie, but it's not the same Morricone at the beginning as at the end. Film director Bernardo Bertolucci observed that there's the famous Morricone, who was Sergio Leone's composer and who with him invented the sound of the Italian Western. But he also suggested that there are various other Morricones that represent different aesthetic and compositional aspects. For Bertolucci, the music is able to go back to Verdi, to go into the peasant song, the music of the collective heart, so that without knowing it, Morricone wrote two or three beautiful possible national anthems for Italy. Simon Frith perceives the composer as an equally pivotal figure, but for him, Morricone is the line that runs from Puccini to dub music. And he's able to draw on music's ability to cross and confuse cinematic and cultural codes. We can see, I think, some of the features of Morricone's compositional style, as identified by both Bertolucci and Frith, mapped on to Tarantino's approaches in Inglourious Basterds. Obviously, it's clear that Morricone is especially associated through his collaboration with Sergio Leone with the spaghetti Western. Originally coined as a pejorative term by critics to highlight the supposed inauthenticity of non-American Westerns, the spaghetti Western was a subgenre that emerged in the mid-1960s. Principally directed by Italians, originally released in the Italian language and often filmed in Spain, they were more bleak and gritty than many American Westerns of the time. What Leone and Morricone provided was a European perspective on the mythic notion of the Old West, as exemplified by the Westerns of John Ford, for example. In essence, the spaghetti Western first demythologized and then, I would argue, remythologized the frontier and its inhabitants. Codes of honor were upturned with heroes that were only slightly less evil than the villains. The bleakness of the landscape was not merely presented, audiences were encouraged to feel its harshness. Long sequences without dialogue and extreme close-ups resulted in what Jameson has described as operas in which arias are not sung, but stared. The spaghetti Western celebrates the process of mythologizing, and Morricone's music was, I think, fundamental in shaping its success. Now, the key to the effectiveness of Morricone's music in Leone's films lies in the opportunities for the foregrounding of musical moments, Royal Brown observed that Leone's extension of action in time allowed the music more room to expand, so that Morricone had the luxury of writing developed themes that have musical logic while generating ample amounts of cinematic affect. It's also clear that the composer and director believed in an aesthetic approach which rejected fundamental aspects of the Hollywood Western. And Christopher Frayling has written extensively about this, if you're interested. Indeed, from the very outset of their collaboration on A Fistful of Dollars, it was clear that Leone was searching for a different kind of sound and wanted to work in a different kind of way to achieve it. Leone suggested that music should be composed before the film was shot so that he could use it to help formulate ideas about its potential impact. Frayling noted that this first project was far too advanced and too sparsely budgeted for such an innovation. But in subsequent projects, sequences were built around the pre-composed music. And in Once Upon a Time in the West, from 1968, for example, the music was even played on set with a direct influence on the performances of the characters. And interestingly, Tarantino, of course, likes to play music on set to help his actors. So, Morricone's music is effective as film music precisely because it's not been created and does not function in the same way as most other film music. It has its own structural logic that is not defined by the particular picture editing configurations. The images are frequently shaped around the music. Furthermore, Morricone's music is commonly built through the transition of short motives into overarching structures that are reminiscent of the verse-chorus structures of popular music, of which he wrote quite a lot before he became a successful film composer. The Italian musicologist Sergio Micheli refers to this as a microcell technique. So for a director who likes to use pre-existing music, such as Tarantino, we can immediately understand the appeal of Morricone's music. It can easily be manipulated in structural terms, has a clear link to popular music practice, both in gestural approach and instrumentation, and has a clear life and identity beyond the film. Much of Morricone's film music is very widely available on record, and Tarantino owns all of it. Whilst also, of course, being fundamental to the development of the identity of the given film and all of those things that are obvious about the collaboration between the music and the image in those films. So that's a bit of context for why Morricone. I want to now explore three different scenes from Inglourious Basterds, which all use Morricone's music in some way and demonstrate this mashup process in action. Broadly speaking, the three examples move from a juxtaposition of spaghetti Western mood with World War II iconography to something that Tarantino has described as more operatic, and we'll get on to that. So, the opening scene of Inglourious Basterds features a homestead set against an expansive landscape with a lone figure, Monsieur Lapadite, chopping wood. In the distance, we see army vehicles approaching. A chapter title has just appeared and frames what we're about to see, Once Upon a Time in Nazi-Occupied France. If this is not a clue to an audience, then I don't know what else is. Once Upon a Time starts this film. The music cue used is Dopo la Condanna, taken from Sergio Salima's spaghetti western La Resa dei Conti, which is called The Big Gun Down in its English translation. And the music here was composed by Ennio Morricone. So this is the opening of Inglourious Basterds.
Est-ce la propriété de Berger Lapadite?
Je suis pas Lapadite.
C'est un plaisir de vous rencontrer, monsieur Lapadite. Je suis le colonel SS Hans Lang.
Que puis-je faire?
J'espérais que vous m'inviteriez à rentrer chez vous, afin que nous puissions avoir une discussion.
Okay, so that's the opening of the film. And I think one of the most striking features about the music is that the score quotes Beethoven's Bagatelle No. 25 in A minor, commonly known as Für Elise. And its opening gesture is one of the most instantly recognisable phrases in music history. Just in case you don't know what that is, it sounds like this. Now, in Morricone's music cue, Beethoven's opening gesture remains on a piano, but is recontextualised within the harmonic and orchestrational context of the spaghetti western sound. Morricone provides extra repetitions of the D sharp, creating an extended version of what's labelled motif X there that appears four times during the cue. That motif first resolves onto A minor, as in Beethoven's original, but in the subsequent appearances, the concluding note A is placed over F major and D minor seventh harmony before finally resolving on an A minor at the end of the cue. Interspersing these statements, improvisatory classical guitar passages based on the Aeolian mode act as answering phrases, often moving over parallel block harmony. Chords F, D and E, if you're interested. In addition, orchestral strings, a lyrical French horn melody, and rhythmic affected electrical guitar patterns contribute to Morricone's typical spaghetti western sound. So, even before Tarantino used this music, it was already a mashup. In its original context, this juxtaposition of musical materials had a clear narrative justification. The story of La Resa dei Conti centres around a man called Manuel Cuchillo Sanchez, who has been framed for the rape and murder of a child by a wealthy landowner and power broker known simply as Broxton. The real culprit is Broxton's son-in-law. Broxton hires Jonathan Corbett, a gunman with a reputation for bringing criminals to justice, to hunt down Sanchez. And after several encounters, Corbett begins to have some doubts about his quarry's guilt. And annoyed at Corbett's inability to catch Sanchez, Broxton arrives in Mexico to take over the manhunt, aided by his Austrian bodyguard, the Baron von Schulenburg. So, we have learned that this mustachioed Austrian is the best gunman in Europe, with 33 duels and 33 wins under his belt. He also happens to be a skilled pianist, and we even hear him play Für Elise while he boasts about his dueling prowess to Corbett. So here's a scene that's designed to demonstrate cultured precision and ruthless efficiency. So this is a scene with Baron von Schulenburg and Corbett, the two sort of hired guns in the film.
Quasi tutti fissano la mano, quello con cui spara. Io no. Io guardo gli occhi. Perché un attimo prima che la mano si muova, gli occhi la tradiscono. E leggete scritto la morte. La vostra? O la sua?
For those of you that don't speak Italian, von Schulenburg was saying there, hey, Broxton, when you're in a duel, what do you look at? Most people look at the gunman's hands, not me. I look at the eyes, because the hand can give it away, but the eyes tells the truth, and that's the difference between your death or theirs, something like that. Right? So that's what he's saying while he's playing the Beethoven. So the film's climactic sequences involve several Mexican standoffs in which the genuine murderer, von Schulenburg, and Broxton are all killed by Corbett and Sanchez. Morricone's cue, Dopo la Condanna, complete with that Beethoven quotation, is of course used during Corbett's duel with von Schulenburg and highlights differences between the two skilled gunmen. One is precise, measured, efficient, and European, and the other more free-spirited, improvisatory, and from the frontier. So this is the music that we heard at the opening of Inglourious Basterds and how it was originally used.
Mentre eravate di quelli che prima sparano e poi pensano, vi siete sbagliato stavolta. Corbett, siete un po' troppo furbo per fare il segnatore. Avanti, barone, è vostro.
So in the context of Inglourious Basterds, that Beethoven quotation acquires even greater layers of meaning. Richard Etlin observed that the Nazi Party used cultural heroes to strengthen its political agenda and, quote, Beethoven was promoted as an artist who represented national socialist heroic ideals. Indeed, Beethoven was privileged and placed beside Wagner as representative of German supremacy, and German musicologists were even commissioned to rewrite the history of German music in accordance with Nazi principles. So the use of Beethoven taps into this historical association with the Third Reich, and the cue as a whole acquires meaning from both its previous filmic context and its new placement. Beethoven is mashed and reshaped, but so is the sight and sound of the spaghetti western and the visual metaphor of the war movie. The second example I want to explore is of particular interest for its very brief distorted guitar riff, moving from the flattened subtonic to the tonic minor, derived from Billy Preston's score for Slaughter from 1972. This is used as a kind of theme for the character Hugo Stieglitz, the only German member of the Bastards who's notorious for his sadistic ways of murdering Nazis. There he is. I want to suggest that the music in this scene engages what I would describe, for want of a better term, as the spaghettification of pre-existing tracks. By this, I mean that the way a music track is used, regardless of its original context, or whether it's even by Ennio Morricone, is deliberately reminiscent of the form and function of Morricone's music in Leone's spaghetti Western films, especially in the relation to the manipulation of time and the creation of myth. Let me just play you an example of where we're introduced to Hugo Stiglitz and the rest of the bastards, so you get a sense of what we're doing. Stop it there before it gets too violent. Okay. What we were actually listening to there are two bits of music. One is Morricone's music from Il Mercenario, 1968, and the soundtrack for Slaughter by Billy Preston from 1972. And a group of German soldiers have been captured there by the bastards. So we're introduced to Hugo Stiglitz through this menacing guitar riff and a freeze frame where his name is emblazoned across the screen. Let's just actually have a look at this again, right? So I'm going to show you that, and I'm going to show you something else.
Heard him? Everybody in the German army said you're Hugo Stiglitz.
Okay, so we're introduced to Hugo Stiglitz through this menacing guitar riff in the freeze frame, where his name's emblazoned across the screen, and that's reminiscent of the technique used by Leone in The Good, the Bad and the Ugly from 1966, where each character is labelled by an epithet that appears over a freeze frame of their image, accompanied by Morricone's famous alternating perfect fourth coyote call. The same theme represents all three characters in Leone's film, but it receives a different orchestration on each occasion. In the Stiglitz freeze frame sequence, Tarantino borrows the idea of identificatory gestural boldness from Leone and Morricone's temporal dislocation in order to expand the mythic space. As Sean Cubitt observed, the cinematic freeze is not a photograph because it has a definite duration. The audience is invited to engage both with the suspense and spatialization of time, which is precisely where myth can be shaped, because, as Roland Barthes might have argued, form and meaning are blended into a mode of signification. This approach seems all the more clear because the action on either side of the freeze frame engages in further temporal displacement. First, as the captured German sergeant walks towards Lieutenant Aldo Rain, the action moves into a slow motion sequence featuring Morricone's music from Il Mercenario. Then the distorted guitar theme from Slaughter is heard over a freeze frame before developing into funk rock that accompanies a violent but playful multi-layered flashback showing how Stiglitz came to join the gang. And I didn't show you that bit, but I believe the film is being shown after this, so you can see that then if you want. So overall, this sequence demonstrates a carefully managed control of tempo, slow, pause and fast, that creates a space for the mythic precisely in the manner of Morricone's spaghetti western music. In the two sequences we've seen so far, the audience simultaneously experiences spaghetti western and war movie tropes. Both are mutually recognisable and pluralistically fused. we are not located in either a spaghetti western or a war movie, but in a different, ambiguous space. The third example I want to explore also places us in a liminal space, and Tarantino has referred to this as operatic. That's also a quote from Tarantino. He said this scene was a Romeo and Juliet shootout at a movie premiere. And it demonstrates this approach. Having escaped SS officer Hans Lander several years earlier, Shoshana Dreyfus has assumed a new identity as Emmanuel Mimieux and is the owner of a Paris cinema. German war hero Private Friedrich Zoller, whose exploits are to be celebrated in the Nazi propaganda film Stolz der Nation, or Nation's Pride, takes an interest in her and persuades Joseph Goebbels to hold the premiere at her cinema. With the presence of numerous high-ranking Nazi officials, she plans to take her revenge by locking the audience in the theatre and burning them alive after setting fire to large quantities of highly flammable nitrate film. However, as the plan sprints towards its conclusion, Friedrich Zoller leaves the theatre to find Shoshana Emmanuel in the projection booth. She tries to get rid of him, but he's insistent. And with the promise of a sexual encounter, she persuades him to lock the door and then shoots him in the back. And this is where Morricone's track Un Amico, taken from the film Revolver, is heard. Let's have a look at this sequence.
Tous les autres films, je l'ai fait. J'ai l'intention de supporter des soirées comme celle-ci dans l'esprit du candidat. Cependant, il n'en reste pas moins que ces films s'inspirent de mes exploits militaires. Et en l'occurrence, mon exploit consiste au fait que j'ai tué beaucoup d'hommes. En conséquent, la partie du film que j'étais maintenant, je n'aime pas regarder cette partie.
Je suis désolée, Frédéric.
Non, je me suis dit que j'allais monter et faire ce que je fais le plus, vous embêter. Et avoir la tête que vous faites, il semblerait que je n'ai pas perdu la main.
C'est tellement habitué ce que le Messie ou les Schlegel que vous avez oublié ce que signifie le nom. Non, vous ne pouvez pas rester ici. Maintenant, allez-vous-en. Vous m'avez fait mal.
Parfois, ça fait plaisir de voir que vous pouvez ressentir quelque chose, même si c'est juste de la douleur physique. Je ne suis pas un homme à qui on dit allez-vous-en. Il y a plus de 300 cadavres en Italie qui, s'il le pouvait, en témoignerait. Après tout ce que j'ai fait pour vous, vous me manquez de respect à vos risques à ces périls.
Fermez la porte.
Quoi ?
Fermez la porte à clé. On n'a pas beaucoup de temps.
De temps pour quoi ?
Non, mais laissez tomber.
Non, attendez. Vous voulez que je ferme la porte à clé ?
La 50e fois, oui.
Thank you. qui est à Cannes.
So, despite the fact that Shoshana has just shot Zola, the instrumental version of Morricone's track Un Amico seems to generate some kind of tenderness between them. The lyrical melody and gentle textures seem to suggest regret. The gentle main theme enters as Zola groans in pain and Shoshana goes over to him. Perhaps she does not loathe Zola as a person, but what he represents. However, as the music develops into its most expansive phrase, Zola, who's been lying down on the floor, turns and shoots Shoshana. So the meaning of this scene seems ambiguous as we experience the blood-splattered, slow-motion death of the two characters. Does Tarantino generate dissonance between graphic violence and sweet music? Does the sequence represent the aestheticization of violence? Is there something darkly sexual about the bodies writhing in slow motion as they lay bleeding and dying? Much has been written about Tarantino's use of music in relation to violence, particularly the notion of ironic counterpoint, a concept that numerous writers have found increasingly unsatisfactory. Phil Powery, for example, argues that counterpoint exists not between what you see and what you hear in the torture sequence in Reservoir Dogs, but between the act of seeing and the act of hearing. Lisa Coulthard likewise argues that music in Tarantino's scenes of violence is more than mere accompaniment, ironic commentary or contradiction. It's essential in the audiovisual construction of spectatorial enjoyment and engagement. Coulthard also understands Tarantino's aesthetic approach as emphasising the superficial nature of his film texts so that they can be viewed and enjoyed within the context of pleasurable, effective and analytic passivity. I would align that theoretical perspective with Greg Redner's attempts to find methodological connections between musicology and film theory by using the French philosopher Gilles Deleuze. In particular, the notion of sensation seems apposite. Deleuze proposed the idea that art is experienced as pure sensation rather than contemplation. The arts create novel combinations of sensation and feeling, that is to say, a compound of, of percepts and affects. So the move away from representational analytical perspectives towards those that focus on intensities of experience and highlight affect and hapticity seem a valuable way of approaching much of Tarantino's work. Redner suggests that by considering the Deleuzian concept of precognitive sensation, it becomes possible to hear a score in its purest form, thereby enabling us to understand an expanding flow moving forwards towards the greater plane, which is the entirety of the filmic universe. The Un Amico sequence certainly engages in a way that goes beyond simplistic counterpoint between image and music. It seems to me that something close to Deleuze's notion of sensation is precisely what Tarantino was thinking of when he described the use of Morricone in this sequence as operatic. Shoshana's bright red dress, Zola's cream uniform jacket, the humane and lyrical melody, and the beautiful slow motion creates a narrative sequence that's ambiguous about the tragic, the tender, and the impact of brutalistic violence. The music does not explain or express the images, it renders them physically sensible. So the three examples we've looked at all represent different kinds of mashup processes in action. I suggest that the deliberate exploration of liminal spaces where history and its representation are in conflict is what ultimately challenges the audience in the film's concluding sequences. And we'll get on to that. In his discussion of the use of Morricone's Un Amico, Tarantino observed that he'd been waiting for an opportunity to use the track for many years. Recalling its original use in the film Revolver, the director explained, "I remember thinking, wow, this is fantastic, but it doesn't really quite go with this movie." The same attitude is also evident in other tracks used in the film, including David Bowie's Cat People, which originally appeared in Paul Schrader's movie of Cat People 1982. Tarantino said, "I've always loved that song and I was always disappointed by how Paul Schrader used it in the movie. He didn't really use it, he threw it in over the closing credits." So Tarantino's use of pre-existing music from other films aims to correct perceived past errors or miscalculations. By giving a track the treatment it truly deserves, there's an attempt to write cinematic history. And this approach, of course, sits very comfortably within the ideals of mashup culture, where new combinations focusing on undervalued or forgotten materials are cherished. Cat people putting out fire is used for one of the film's most striking sequences, where Shoshana engages in a kind of participatory ritual before setting fire to her own cinema. Let's have a look at that sequence, actually, for which I need to go to iTunes.
Mir scheint auf jeden jemand. Jemand frisch im Nebel ist.
Warte mal aus!
Max. Alles Liebe. Bridget von Hamas.
So blue, an ageless
Okay, so it's clear there's a close alliance between the visual editing, the lyrics, and the structure of the music in this sequence. It begins with slow fades from establishing shot to extreme close-up, while Bowie's brooding baritone voice drones. But as his voice reaches impassioned heights on the word gasoline, the tempo suddenly increases and we see Shoshana putting on her makeup. This is no ordinary preparation for an important night. After all, she tells us she's going to be putting out the fire with gasoline. And on the line, "See these eyes so red," she takes her red cream blusher and aggressively applies it as war paint. She rhythmically loads the magazine into her pistol on the fourth beat of the bar before the start of a new verse, "Still this pulsing night." The entrance of the fourth verse, "See these tears so blue," coincides with the mid-close-up as she puts on her cocktail hat and we slowly watch her lower her veil in focused readiness. The music's unbridled emotion screams in anticipation, while Shoshana herself remains intensely poised. This scene fetishizes her personal preparations for the premiere of Stolz Der Nation, but the central section also fetishizes filmmaking itself. We see Shoshana and Marcel making the movie insert, their attempts to get it developed, and over a repetitive guitar riff, the joining together of two sections of nitrate film using a splicer and cement. Tarantino gives this song a cinematic treatment that he felt was warranted but never received in its original incarnation. Now, on the face of it, Inglourious Basterds seems utterly unconcerned with the ethics of war or the accuracy of history, and is instead focused on the power of cinema, as we've just seen. The characters, for example, include a British soldier who used to be a film scholar and a German movie star working as a double agent. The climax of the film depends upon the flammability of nitrate film stock. Trapped in a movie theatre, the audience is consumed by flames while Shoshana's phantasmagorical effigy laughs hysterically as they burn and exclaims, "This is the face of Jewish vengeance." When Hitler is assassinated, countless rounds of machine gun fire, resonating with the force of wish fulfillment, literally disintegrate his body. Tarantino indulges in the latent bloodlust of revenge, but the film is not just a revenge fantasy. In the climactic moments, there's a rupture between historical reality and its representation, raising numerous questions about the exploitative influence of cinema and the morality of vengeance. Films reshape history even when they attempt to be resolutely faithful, and history is always recounted from a particular perspective or with an agenda. The public memory of war in the 20th century has arguably been created more by a manufactured past than a remembered one, as John Chambers and David Culbert remind us. But by so shamelessly rewriting history and making the mechanics of the process overt, Inglourious Basterds ultimately demands its audience ignore truth in a bold assertion of the fantastical power of cinema. But fiction does not emerge as the victor. There is no sense in which reality has been replaced or eroded, because the film continually signals and questions the act of its own representation. The audience, I would argue, is forced to confront that spectatorial position. The rejection of realism throughout the film has been explicitly demanded through the use of mashup techniques that highlight numerous liminal spaces and call to question everything that the film presents. Inglourious Basterds ultimately problematizes the nature of historical misrepresentation in film generally and in the war movie specifically. The film sets up all the typical war movie conventions, but journeys through them in new ways, drawing attention to them and questioning their cultural dominance. The use of spaghetti western music in particular seems designed to experiment with the very issues that Baudrillard highlighted in relation to the real and the hyperreal, and seems to me to act as a direct challenge to the pessimistic view of postmodern society's perceived inability to distinguish between reality and its representation. So is this film an inglorious bastardization? Probably yes, but really I think that's the point. In a clearly demarcated cinematic fantasy space, the audience is constantly caught in between genres, between historical fact and fantasy, between music tracks that belong simultaneously in several contextual locations. The approach taken in Inglourious Basterds exemplifies the aesthetic sensibilities of mashup, where appropriation, reinvention, and re-meaning are fundamental goals. And Tarantino clearly adores this liminal space and places the audience at its centre in order to celebrate its multifarious, resonant, provocative, and problematic associations. Tarantino's latest film, Django Unchained, is set in the United States pre-Civil War Deep South. And the film follows a freed slave who treks across the United States with a bounty hunter on a mission to rescue his wife from a cruel and charismatic plantation owner. Tarantino stated that he wanted, quote, to do movies that deal with America's horrible past with slavery, but do them like spaghetti westerns, not like big issue movies. I want to do them like their genre films, but they deal with everything that America has never dealt with because it's ashamed of it, and other countries don't really deal with because they don't feel they have the right to. I would suggest, following the line of argument that I've presented today, that Django Unchained is also a mashup, but here we have a Western mashed with a Southern. It also has a problematic, climatic and cathartic revenge moment at the end of the film, which I won't spoil for those of you that haven't seen it. It also celebrates playing with history. It also places extraordinary combinations of music and image together, creating surprising and engaging juxtapositions that are concerned with sensation. It also creates interesting clashes with genre that constantly question the mode of its storytelling. There's even a Beethoven Thurlese quotation. Can you have a light sound? If you haven't seen this film, I thoroughly recommend it. And I think a lot of the things that I've been talking about today with Inglourious Basterds, I think, map directly onto an aesthetic approach that's being taken in Django Unchained as well. And we wait to see if Tarantino continues in this direction. Thank you very much. I think if we talk about it along the lines that I've been arguing, I think we could suggest that Tarantino is becoming more bold in this. Right? I think he always knew he wanted to use the Django Unchained song anyway at the beginning of that. I don't know, it may be that he just doesn't think the music's very good for that original Inglourious Basterds film or not particularly relevant. What I think is interesting is that we're talking about Morricone and how he had approached him for Inglourious Basterds. And then they didn't work together. But he has worked with a composer for Django Unchained, and he's working there with another Italian composer, Louis Bacalov. Right? And that's as significant a shift as I can think of in Tarantino's working method. After years and years of just rejection of the idea of working with composers, that he would engage in that way, and there is thematic material that's used, original material composed for the film. So I see it as part of this trend that I've been talking about. So we have to see. I mean, you know, if the next film includes a composer who's written most of the music, then I've argued the right kind of thing. You know? But who knows with Tarantino, that might go.
Thank you so much, Nicola. I'm fascinated by the topic of revenge, of trauma and revenge, and then the interval of minor second as representing this oscillation between two pitches,
yeah,
so close to each other as can be in this system. And then this Beethoven. So I would like to go to the beginning of your lecture and to this beginning of the film, Once Upon a Time in Nazi-occupied France, and there is this Morricone theme from the film La Resa dei Conti that uses this Beethoven, and it exaggerates the minor second motif. And actually, it's the same motif or cell that is also in harmonica Once Upon a Time in the West, because that's the interval which the Charles Bronson, the harmonica, the character is blowing there. Yeah. And that's really an important motif there in the film. Actually, the whole film, Once Upon a Time, is West is filled with music where this cell of minor seconds, and it's really the atmosphere of revenge and trauma that the characters are breathing there. So now, of course, that's done 2 years later than this La Resa dei Conti, but of course it's more famous film, and I think that film, this Once Upon a Time in West, really established, at least to my ears now, this idea of revenge or revenge and trauma as the postulation between minus again somehow. So I would like to know what you think about that. It also resonates in the same way. I think it's between E and E flat, and then it's also the A minor.
Yeah.
Minor in that film, and of course there's also other films where Spaghetti Westerns, and there are of course Tarantino films, also in Kill Bill, where there is this Louis Bacalov's music actually from the Grand Duello. It's in that anime chapter where this origin of
I remember.
I think it's there too. I can't remember now how, but probably. Well, I think I
had not made that connection, but I think it's a great idea. It's worth exploring. The question of whether it just applies to revenge is, of course, where there will be a challenge, right?
Yeah.
Because, of course, that interval, especially if you're thinking about certain kinds of chords that move from the flattened subtonic to the tonic because of that kind of resolution.
Yeah.
If you're thinking about it in modal music, we're more likely to have that kind of movement.
Yeah.
But I think
it's not the tense there.
Yes.
But if you think that it's between two pitches, and there's also in these great duels that are, so there's also these two characters.
Exactly, yeah.
So
that it's there embodied
between them and this tension,
I think that's worth looking into to see if there's the semitone and revenge. Yeah. But I mean, it's like
it's so clear in harmony.
Yeah. I think what's the Philip Tagg article, Tritonal Crime?
Yes,
you know, that,
and it's
that
electric
one?
Cowboys.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
So I think something along those lines, you could probably draw quite a lot of connection.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
It was fine that it was in that Django too. I didn't remember that it's there.
No, yes,
so
yeah.
It's really funny.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's completely playful and referencing back to
Inglourious
Basterds,
yes,
it seems to me.
Yes.
Because Christoph Waltz, of course, is interestingly, we're in Dentalia, by the way, and Christoph Waltz's character is a dentist. I don't know if it was deliberate or not.
Yeah, it's interesting in terms of Tarantino's technique. I recently saw an Oscar roundtable discussion of the Hollywood Reporter, which is available on YouTube, where they gather all the directors who are nominated that year to discuss that topic. And Tarantino was there to discuss Django, and Tom Hooper was there to discuss Les Miserables. And they discussed the technique in how he made Les Miserables, where they were playing the music while and
they were singing on set,
singing live, and then the discussion shifted to Tarantino saying that when he heard that he used that technique, he said that if he ever made a musical,
that's how he would.
That's
do.
The only way that he feels that he could make that's the only technique, because he feels that the moment is so important that he doesn't want anybody to lose that over the final product. He said that he didn't have any plans for making a musical, but he felt that he is in a way a musical director, that all his films have sort of musical numbers, but he's sort of not wanting to make a full film of them. And I thought that it was really interesting, and it reflects to this that he plays music on the sets and so on, and sort of takes that music as the starting point, probably in a lot of the sequences.
Yeah, that's well documented. I was kind of equally fascinated and frightened about what a Tarantino musical might be like.
a lot of the directors were sort of they encouraged him that you should
you should go into a musical.
Yeah. They were all entertaining.
You should have done Sweeney Todd, I feel.
Sweeney Todd, yeah. No, well, yeah, that would be fantastic. And there's no question that music is a big part of his thinking and shapes the way he writes scripts. And and I think, if you, just following this, Susanna's line of argument, if you wanted to think about how he structures his films in musical form, through the use of music, that would be, I think, a really valid way of thinking about Haran, how he works, whether it's quite as, as formally structured and clear-cut as we might discuss it, but those processes are certainly going on, I think, in his mind. He's certainly looking for those interesting juxtapositions almost always. And the music is almost always a starting point.
Richard Dyer has recently written on the use of pastiche as a resource. I was just thinking what he was talking about, Rota and stuff like that, but I think it resonates with, Tarantino would be a quintessential example of this kind of thing. Would you comment on that?
I've not read the the Richard Dyer book on pastiche, so I need to be a bit careful about what I say that. but I've read his book on Nino Rota. And I think there are some similarities, and I think, the fact that Tarantino keeps going back to Italian composers is significant, right?
Or it's a tribute, in a way.
Yes, exactly. So there's something going on there. And it may, it may be about a kind of a degree of self-referentialism or self-awareness in that music, and certainly in the foregrounding of that music, that's very clear in Nino Rota, if you look at all of those Fellini collaborations or whatever, it's a very, very interesting and, clear place for the music within those films. That's not always the case in other films of the same era. So I don't know, I would want to look at that question across sort of Italian film music of that era more closely. We've got Rota, Mericone, Bacalov, these kinds of things. I would be careful about saying anything about the pastiche side of your question. Although Richard Dyer's work is always, it's always fascinating, always very, very well written. So.
I have one question, or more of a comment really, and it has to do with the use of existing music, which I think is a trait of New Independent and auteur films. Claudia Gordon has written about that in her work on auteur music.
Yeah.
And I think that I wonder whether Tarantino's reluctance to work with the composer has something to do with control.
Yes.
And a matter of agency and independence.
Yeah.
Because we're dealing with the genre of independent film. And independence means independence from the industry, but it also means keeping control of everything yourself. And you can do that if you're a DJ, if you're a mashup artist, because you're the one controlling the mix.
Yeah.
So I think that's a factor. And if we look at the history of auto music, from uses of popular music in Jarmusch, Anderson.
Yeah.
Whatever to Kubrick's films and his use of the 10 track in 2001 Space Odyssey. In all of those works and in Kubrick's Uber in general, it's all about Kubrick's decisions.
There's no question that Tarantino is a control freak and wants to be responsible for all of those kind of elements. I was about to cheekily say that every director I've worked with has also been a control freak, regardless of whether it's independent film or not, but that's the kind of another point. But there's certainly something in that independent spirit and wanting to have a voice through every aspect that's in the film, whether it's how it's framed or whether it's any aspect of it has got that auteurist sort of voice through it. You can't miss the fact that you walk into a cinema, it's a Tarantino film, right? You can't miss that. And same for some of the other directors that you're talking about. And we saw a Michel Gondry film earlier in the week, and you kind of know, and it's the same tradition. There's a sense of ownership which defines the trajectory of that film. So yeah, absolutely. I think there's something in that for sure.
I suppose the other alternative is a director like Hitchcock, who worked with Bernard Berman, or Lynch and Bela Lamenti. So
yeah.
The partnership is so close that they together develop
a style
that is distinctive.
Yeah.
That
pairing. And you know, maybe Tarantino will go in this direction. Let's see what happens with Louis. But I'm hoping for the phone call, by the way.
Yeah.
but it doesn't seem to have happened. But I suspect that he's not going to be like that. You know, if you want to collaborate with a composer, you know, you start doing that in your early films, and you get it going. If you've defined your career so much by the use of your pre-existing music and the choices you make, then I think it's pretty hard to give that up, actually. So I think there'll be elements of working with the composer, but under very, very strict kind of conditions. And that gives him the choice to go, I'm not using that, you know. You mentioned Kubrick, there are plenty of examples of Kubrick doing precisely that, you know. It doesn't work for me, and it's my film, so tough luck, you know.
Well, I wonder if this kind of mixing of this very brutal, extreme violence and beautiful music is very common for these Italian directors like Ruggero Deodato.
Right.
It is.
You're asking me, or you're saying that you think it is?
Well, both.
Yes, but along the lines of what we were talking about with Nino Rota or someone like that, Richard Dyer's conception of that Italianness, there's a lyrical nature to it, but not the way that Tarantino does it. You know, it's extremes at both ends. You know, extremes in the Un Amico sequence that we saw there is very saccharine, that music. You know. On its own, a bit sickly, actually. Yeah? And this extremely sort of beautiful, blood-spattered sort of violence. So it's really complicated what's going on there. I don't really have a good way of getting a handle on the complexity of the processes that are happening there. And I think a lot of scholars have tried to grapple with this. Lisa Coulthard most effectively, I think. I can't remember what her paper's called. Can you remember what that paper's called?
I've read it.
Hang on, I might have it in my... See if I can find it. Coulthard, can't see it. But she talks about the violence and the use of music in Tarantino's films. She describes it as allowing the audience to enter into a kind of passive, non-analytical kind of state. And I don't quite agree with that, actually. I think it's more complex than that, even. But nonetheless, I think her article is the best kind of attempt to try and grapple with what's going on in these particular kind of scenes for Tarantino.
Yeah, I was thinking that maybe also it's something to do, the violence and beautiful music, that's an operative theme.
Yeah.
Because in operas you have horrible violence all the time, and suicide areas, and they are so beautiful. For example, Puccini's Man and Butterfly, the end of it, it's horrible. It's really Tarantino-like, Zen suicide. And there's this...
She dies for like 15 minutes while she's singing.
And it's quite similar in a way. So
yeah, he operatic. Used this term operatic.
Yeah.
And, again, I'm not sure he's quite on top of that term. But nonetheless, I think there's something to be said about that. Sure.
I was just thinking that there's this kind of what's the the thrilling thing about the Italians, and it might be to do with some kind of European cultural pessimism. I mean, in the sense, especially with Leone thinking about Westerns and then taking this kind of, he was talking about them being Romans and look what happened to the Romans and so on.
Yeah. But you would see that as distinct from, let's say, French film or Spanish film. Or, It's interesting. I mean, I did this book, European Film Music, and what was funny, just to sort of pick up on this point a bit, was all the American reviewers hated it because they didn't like the idea that Europe was not one entity. And, you know, the whole point of the book was to go, there is no sense of European. There's some sense of it afar, but it's individual nation states pursuing their own kind of thing. And European reviewers got that, and the Americans didn't. So I don't know, maybe Tarantino is more sensitive. You know, we know that he's a film scholar. He knows lots and lots of films, and films that no one else has seen, you know, he knows in detail. So he probably has an affinity much more with variety of different European sort of cinemas. So.
And it even goes to the language level. I mean,
of
the
course.
Dialogue with Hans Landa and that that landowner there in the hut.
Yeah.
The use of French there, they were talking about milk, and there's another reference for that stuff. And
yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, this film. I mean, if those of you who are about to see it and haven't seen it, you know, we've got French, German, English, received pronunciation English, parody English, Americans, parody American, you know.
Ari DeVergie.
Yeah, so, exactly. So, and that's quite bold for what, it's not a mainstream film, but Tarantino by default is so popular that it's going to be mainstream, right? So in America, this is to think about how that's perceived with all these different kind of languages. Yeah.
I was just continuing the idea of key developed there, and this you showed the David Bowie piece from the film, and the idea that Tarantino picks a theme from an existing film and wants to do it like better or the right way.
Yeah.
And this made me think of Godard, which I think Godard speaks or says at some point it might be in connection to Histoire. Cinema collection that there are films, filmmakers who have used color and light in a particular way, but not the correct way. So he wants.
So I'm going to do it properly. Right.
The same attitude. This kind of relationship with the past.
Yeah.
Might be a thing that connects Tarantino to Godard.
Maybe. And again, you know, but we're talking about auteur directors, aren't we?
Mm.
You know, always. Very clear in their position in cinema history and their relationship to those kind of materials.
Very
conscious of it. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
I think if there are no further questions, I think we can stop the discussion there. And thank you again.
Thank you.